talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the kaleidoscopic history of London from the swinging 60s to the rise of Margaret Thatcher, spycraft in the age of Elizabeth I and how to try out some of the tricks at home, and to end the show, humanitarianism and the reconstruction of European intellectual life after the First World War. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. A new book traces how swinging London captured the world's attention in the mid-1960s, discarding post-war austerity as it built a global reputation for youthful confidence and innovative music and fashion. And the book covers topics as varied as the rise and fall of boutique fashion, Soho and the sex trade, cabbies and tourists, gentrification, conservation, suburbia and the welfare state. The book is called Waterloo Sunrise, London from the 60s to Thatcher. It's published in paperback by Princeton University Press. The author is John Davis. And John, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Your first chapter is Why London, Why Now? And it begins with this idea of London being repeatedly discovered in the 1960s. And also the idea of it being the most swinging city in the world at that time, which was certainly that image that it developed and how people and writers began to perceive it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to remember it, but not to have been part of it. I was born in the mid-50s and grew up in London, because I am a Londoner. And I was very conscious that something was going on. I mean, even at the age of 9, 10, when the swinging London thing was beginning to take off, obviously I was aware, as all people at my primary school were, I was aware of the revolution in music. I was also aware that the West End that we visited from time to time when in the family was regarded as a very exciting place. Having looked at it now as an academic researcher, I can see, I'm reluctant to abandon that idea. There's been a kind of orthodoxy that's grown up with historians who were born rather later than I was, who rushed to say that this only happened in limited circles of people, and they're all rather well off, and it was just a kind of rich person's playground, and so on, and we shouldn't take it too seriously. Of course, there's a degree of truth in that, but it was also a place, London, in the mid-60s that contrasted very strongly with the London of a few years before, the London I was actually born into. I was aware of that contrast because I was born into what was still an austerity city, really still a Victorian city that had taken an absolute pasting during the Second World War and was still recovering from it. And I was aware that something was changing. So the first chapter of the book is devoted to trying to assess what did happen, what didn't, and how much it mattered to people.
And I like the way it is organised thematically. So there are these series of 16 essays, and they're self-contained, and you can dip in and out. And let's look at the one about eating out in London and the delights of the palate. Was it really a great time in terms of food and in terms of restaurants?
It was getting better all the time, I think. For a long time in the austerity years, I mean, initially, of course, when rationing still applied to various products, it was actually impossible to produce decent meals unless you somehow dodged the ration system. Then from about the late 50s, early 60s, the food scene begins to take off. And the point I'm anxious to make in that chapter is that London's a diverse city, and what you get in this period is the emergence of a very diverse cuisine. That it's not like Paris, where you have maybe very, very high standards of cuisine, but all much of a muchness in their nature, that London becomes the home to all manner of different international cuisines, starting with the Italian, the trattoria revolution, if you can call it that, but diversifying to a point, to the point that by the late 1970s, you could find pretty well any type of food in London if you looked hard enough. There might only be one or two Korean restaurants or whatever, but they were still there. That's something that I can remember mid to late 70s, that it suddenly had become a very exciting place to discover new cuisine.
And what about the seedier elements of London life then? Because you also look at Soho, you look at the questions about sex and sex shops and all of that. And even the way these sex shops seem to like drive out some of the residents and they very much change the nature of the area.
Yeah, it sort of escalates very, very rapidly. I mean, the area had always had a kind of, well, first of all, Soho had always had a sort of bohemian side to it. And it was only a sort of short extension from there to move into the whole sex shop, strip club, dirty cinema, dirty bookshop sort of world. It was a trade that concentrated itself in a very limited area in the way that a lot of trades do. You know, I mean, to me, looking at it in a completely kind of amoral way, it was very similar to, say, the jewellery trade focusing on Clerkenwell, or a lot of the furniture trade or tailoring trades in the East End. It just happened that the Soho area, which had always been a bit naughty, suddenly became very naughty indeed in the 60s. And that escalation, as you said just now, drove out everything else to the point where the area threatened to become like parts of Amsterdam are today, say. And at that point, we stand back. At that point, the local authorities and some evangelical religious people, and also the people in charge of the kind of health and safety aspect of all this, say, well, you know, this should not go any further. And there's a kind of fight back in the 70s. The whole thing demonstrates the kind of power of 60s permissiveness, but also the limits to it.
The book doesn't just cover the 1960s, it also covers the 1970s. But I think maybe readers might be a little intrigued and surprised to see that subheading goes London from the 60s to Thatcher, because people wouldn't really connect Margaret Thatcher and the Thatcherite state and the Thatcherite ideas of the 1980s and Britain of the 1980s with this period. But you show that there is a connection, and that in some ways London is anticipating some of the things that happens there.
Yes, that's the overall argument of the book. The book, as you say, consists of 16 chapters that are in themselves self-contained, and you can read any one of them, I hope, on its own. But I was also keen to get across a kind of overarching message, which was exactly what you just said, that there you see in London, particularly in the 70s, but it's there even in the decade before, you see a lot of the ground being prepared for what happens in Britain later. It's a city which shows quite a pronounced gap between the very wealthy and the very poor. But your average London, your Londoner, your median Londoner, or whatever you want to call him or her, enjoys a consistent improvement in his or her standard of living despite the high inflation rate of the 70s. And that seems to me to anticipate what happens in mainland Britain in the 1980s, that there's a shift away from the kind of safety net mentality of the post-war welfare state that's made possible by the larger numbers of people who are doing better than they had done before. And most people emerge from that process feeling satisfied and not especially resentful of those higher up the income scale who might be doing very well indeed. or for that matter, necessarily particularly concerned about those below them who are suffering. The people who suffer in the 70s are those who are always going to suffer from very high inflation rates. So the unemployed, who are much more numerous then, of course, old age pensioners. London sees a very rapid and precipitate move away from old style industry, the closure of the riverside, the docks and the riverside industries attached to them, but also a lot of other inner city employment simply goes by the board during the economic crises of the 70s. And saying all this, you can run that in parallel with the kind of cultural rejection of the sort of 60s morality that I've already mentioned, the rejection of 60s planning, of 60s architecture, the rise of the building conservation movement in the 60s, 70s as a reaction to the seen as the excesses of the planners. All of that seems to me to anticipate what comes later in Britain as a whole. It's not intended to undermine Thatcher's significance as a historical figure, but rather, I think, to emphasize that she was a massively important historical figure, of course, but nobody can achieve something out of nothing. There has to be a kind of ground preparing movement beforehand. And that, I think, is what happened with Thatcher, that the changes that are underway in what is, you know, to me and to most people, I suppose, the kind of core of England, at least, the changes underway in the core of England in the 1960s, 70s make possible the transmission of those wider changes to England and, by extension, Britain as a whole in the 80s. That's the sort of encapsulation of the overarching argument of the book.
And people would be fascinated by the chapter on property prices and the way they changed. And you definitely see times of boom and times when there were bubbles. In 1972, there seems to have been a huge increase in the prices. And you kind of see a transformation in those who were able to afford homes in this period.
Yeah, there's a steady move towards owner occupation, which is sort of counterbalanced for most of the period by quite a strong impetus for social housing to clear what are perceived as slum areas. And for a long time, in the 20 years or so I'm looking at, for a long time, there's a kind of unacknowledged conflict between the spread of private ownership and what's known as gentrification, though I think that's probably a more limited term than is needed, between the spread of private ownership and the spread of social housing. That's a kind of tension that's there throughout most of the period I'm discussing. But towards the end, it becomes clear which side's winning. Gradually, particularly under the economic pressures of the 70s, that contest tilts towards private ownership, that governments become more and more reluctant to underwrite the major cost of social housing, particularly in cities expensive as London. And it also comes to appear to be more and more vital to buy a house if you can possibly afford to do so. By the end of the period I'm looking at, you're pushing 60% owner occupation and around 30% social housing, I suppose, with the rental sector squeezed to about 12% or something like that. It's another way in which post-war, well, the ideals of the post-objectives of the post-war welfare state gets sort of squeezed out, that the assumption in 1960, I think, would have been that most working class housing, existing working class housing, would have been replaced by council housing. A lot of it was, but by the end of the period, that drive is losing steam.
There is a real glamour about the 1960s in London, and there's a huge amount of nostalgia, and there's a huge mythology built up around it. And, you know, there are so many people who feel like if they could have a time machine, that's where they'd like to go back to for all of the music and glamour and everything that's happening. But how much of that is mythology? How much of that is just a kind of a fake nostalgia about the past?
I think the 60s were okay, actually. And I think, you know, as I said, I didn't experience the kind of frothier side of swinging London because I was too young. But I think I still do think that was a good, well, it's clearly a good time to be young. I mean, young people have money in their pockets in a way that young people 10 years earlier hadn't done. If anything, they had too much of it. I mean, one reason for the fashion explosion and for the music explosion is that people below the age of 25 had an awful lot of disposable income, particularly if they were London born and still living at home for as long as they could and didn't have to pay rent. I think that was a good time to be alive. The 70s, I certainly remember them pretty well. I wouldn't go all the way of saying this period of utter misery. It wasn't, but there were clearly problems in the 70s that were associated with high inflation and as a result with labour problems, with industrial relations problems, with strikes and so on, that made ordinary life difficult in a way that it's quite hard for us to imagine even now when we were sort of beginning to experience inflation again. It's one thing to experience even 10% inflation, as we've had recently, another thing to experience 26% inflation, which is what we had in the mid-70s. So if I could get in that time machine that conjured up, I would happily go back to 1965, 66. I'd love to go back and just see what it was like, to see how well or how badly I have understood it in researching it and writing about it. I think I give the 70s a fairly wide berth, though that's not to say that it was, this was the worst decade of the century or anything like that. But yeah, I wouldn't mind going back to the mid-60s.
Very good indeed. Well, the book takes you back. You don't need the time machine. The book Waterloo Sunrise will transport you back there. It is London from the 60s to Thatcher. It's published in paperback by Princeton University Press. The author, John Davis. And John, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
And thank you very much indeed.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. Early modern Europe was a hotbed of espionage, where spies, spy catchers, and conspirators pitted their wits against each other in deadly games of hide and seek. Theirs was a dangerous trade. Only those who mastered the latest techniques would survive. And a brilliant new book explores the methods spies actually used in the period, including disguises, invisible inks, and even poisons. The book is called Spycraft: Tricks and Tools of the Dangerous Trade from Elizabeth I to the Restoration. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. The authors are Nadine Ackerman and Pete Langman. And Nadine, Pete, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's a very entertaining, very enjoyable read. I have to say, I reached page 240 and there was 100 pages left. And I thought, oh, this must be the footnotes and the bibliography and, you know, where you display all your scholarship and so on. But actually, first, there was this really fascinating thing I'd never seen in a book before, where you entitle it Lessons, the School of Spycraft. You make it clear with a disclaimer, these methods aren't to be used for any nefarious purpose. You're not responsible. It's really for entertainment. But you actually take us through some of the methods, like creating invisible ink. You have the ingredients for counterfeiting seals. It's a very entertaining section where you talk to us about how to make the things described in the book.
Yes, we really want people to try these things at home, because then you sort of suddenly realize how much time these things take and how much skill is actually needed. You really start to appreciate some of the techniques that these people were using.
Absolutely. And it's something that we like you say, we've not seen before. People actually saying, this is what you do, this is how you do it, in book format.
And it's fascinating because by looking at the tricks and the tools of espionage, what you're actually doing in the book is giving us a new insight, a new angle on all of these big events of history in the time of Elizabeth I, in the aftermath of all of that. We're getting a new look at what was actually happening by seeing how it happened.
Oh, absolutely. We take some of the most more well-known plots, such as the Babington plot or the gunpowder plot, and then actually focus on the techniques. And it even surprised us that the stories slightly get more nuanced. Some of the main actors actually change in the Babington plot, known for a plot to assassinate Elizabeth I and then to bring Mary Queen of Scots to the throne of England. Most well known because Mary Queen of Scots, of course, gets executed at the end. But the main actors suddenly are not Mary Queen of Scots in Walsingham, as we all thought they were, but they are the secretaries, her secretaries, the keeper of secrets in this period. So it just changes things.
So maybe let's talk about some of these techniques then. You begin with a chapter on fraud and forgery. How significant, how much of a role did trying to forge these documents, how much did that play?
Documents were incredibly important in this period, especially letters, because the only way, well, the only two ways that you could communicate information over a long distance was either by personal messenger or by letter. So if you were a counter-espionage agent, you either had to intercept a messenger and interrogate them, or you would intercept a letter and interrogate the letter. And of course, if you're opening a letter, then you run the risk of damaging it so much that the people at the other end can tell that you've actually opened it. And of course, you don't want the people you're watching to know that you're watching them. So being able to forge or recreate or mend all these things actually is very important, so that you can recreate the letter and send it on, so that the conspirators at the end have no reason to suspect that you're watching them and listening to them.
And is this really an era of using invisible ink? And you have loads of codes as well, and the cryptography. Is that how these messages then were, when you were trying to send your messages, that you would maybe use a code, you might use invisible ink? You would have all these different techniques to try and protect the messages.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the techniques started from the outside, from the actual letter. So trying to prevent somebody from opening the letter without you actually knowing it. And then once they, if they had got through that first barrier, then you would seek to hide your message in a code or in invisible inks or both, so that it was much more difficult to actually extract the message. And of course, if you're looking at an invisible ink message, then if your message is intercepted, then the chances are that revealing the invisible ink completely destroys the letter. So you would think it's very difficult to send a letter on with an invisible ink message in it, back in invisible ink.
Talk to me about poisons, because the advantage of poisons was that if you wanted to remove an opponent or enemy, they were difficult to detect, but they were also hard to get to the right person and hard to make sure that they succeeded. So it was one of the trickier forms of trying to remove an opponent.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. Again, it all comes down to time. One of the things that obviously you can assassinate somebody relatively easily by stabbing them in the head with a knife, which is relatively straightforward, but of course very, very dangerous for the assassin, because you have to get very, very close, and whoever you're trying to kill is probably got other people around with them. But if you're using poison, then the chances are you can actually, if you know what you're doing, you can get the poison to them and then be out of harm's way while it actually acts. But of course, as you say, that does make it much more difficult to get it to accurately into the right place. So they would use methods. We know certainly that people said they use methods such as smearing contact poisons onto the pommel of a saddle, say, or onto a chair, so that the victims would actually get the poison on their hands and then maybe transfer it to the mouth, depending on what sort of poison it was. Though whether that worked very often is another matter entirely.
Talk to me about the Bravi, because they were a group of killers for hire in Venice, and they used a stiletto, a tiny dagger, to get rid of their enemies.
Yes, the Bravi were, as you say, they were kind of thugs for hire. And their primary mode that they were really associated with, primary mode of assassination, was the stiletto. Now, the stiletto was, I mean, it is effectively where the stiletto heel comes from, because they look very, very similar. It's a long, pointy dagger that was originally designed to finish off an armored opponent. And it was designed so that you could stab them through very weak spots, like the eye slit in a suit of armor. And also it was used as comes from another thing called a poniard, which was used to measure gunpowder in cannon. So this was a very long, very sharp, a very spiky thing that was designed to penetrate, preferably in the head, and then you could move it around to cause the maximum damage. So it had a lot of damage with a very small wound on the outside.
And Nadine, you say in the book that espionage is a messy and unpredictable business, and you describe how spies are slippery and elusive characters. And given that there are these constant battles going on between spies and counter-spies and spy catchers and so on, how successful do we think espionage and spycraft was in this period? Was it something that states engaged in because they hoped it would be successful, or did they have evidence that it did work for them?
Well, of course, this was a very dangerous time. Elizabeth I came to her throne while the country was Catholic. So she was surrounded by a lot of Catholics. There was Spain, there was France, there were a lot of plots to assassinate her. And they wanted to have information. And of course, they foiled the Babington plots, which prevented that from happening. So in that respect, some of these things were successful, but often they weren't successful at all. It didn't really matter in the end. But of course, we don't know what kind of things were prevented. The things we find in the archives are often the reports of unsuccessful spies, the interrogations reports when these spies were caught. So we might also have a very distorted view of history in that respect.
And what about the technological advances? Because things were changing so quickly in this period as well. Did that make the job of the spy that much easier, or did it make it more difficult?
It made it more difficult, certainly in the beginning. We describe about 100 years from the beginning of the reign of Elizabeth I, 1558, until the restoration of the monarchy in 1660. And we follow the history of espionage from an amateur service to a semi-professional service at the end. In the beginning, there was no such thing as a spy master. We often think about Sir Francis Walsingham as the spy master. But there are actually several spy chiefs, and they were all rivals, and they hated each other as well. And they all had their own spy networks, and they tried to gain favor from Elizabeth I, but they didn't necessarily share information. And a lot of spies weren't in permanent employ, and so kept their secrets to themselves. So they never wrote down their techniques, because if they had shared how they did it, they would not find employment again. So they kept their secrets close to their chests, and all recipes needed to be invented again and again as soon as one of these master operatives dies. Another takes in their place, but had to sort of invent their own invisible ink recipe again. At the end of the period, we have Cromwell in charge during the interregnum, and he sort of thinks, let's found the post office and so that all the letters can come through London and we can sort of open them more systematically and with a lot of people in the same office who can all sort of teach each other their techniques. And then you kind of production line going, where men are quite willing to share their secrets, and you have one spy chief in charge. So it's much more centralized at the end of the period.
In technological terms, of course, you have to think that there's a constant battle between spies and counter-spies in, say, technologies regarding cipher codes. The ciphers were getting more and more complex, but also the ways in which they were being broken were getting more and more efficient. So it was a constant battle between the two bunches of people who are hiding behind closed doors, if you like. So it's a technological arms race in the same way that any sort of military campaign had.
So how successful were the spies in this period then? How important was spycraft to the different regimes and the different states?
I think in England was still falling in behind other European countries. They quickly had to catch up because a lot of Jesuits were coming on shore and so trying to undermine the reign of Elizabeth I. So because the letter was really the only communication device in this period over long distance, they had to manipulate that communication device to gain as much information as possible. How successful it was in the end, that is always questionable.
We also have to remember that sometimes the spies and conspirators would actually be overconfident in their own methods and think, well, actually, no one's going to break this. No one's going to be able to open this letter without us seeing. No one's going to break this code. And that overconfidence allowed them to be vulnerable. And that certainly happened in the Babington plot.
Talk to me about poison rings. What were they and how effective were they?
Yes, we have these lovely poison rings that we now sort of question, weren't they just used for relics, or were they actually used to put a little bit of poison into a glass, which could be done, and certainly was done in Italy, where they seem to have much more experience with poisons as well as with stilettos.
The book also has some wonderful illustrations as well, and you really capture in the pictures and in the illustrations exactly what was going on and what was being used. And it really, again, just like the piece at the end of the book, it really helps bring to life what's in there.
Yes, because there are about 60 to 70 images in there, especially to show people how tactile a subject it is. Even we talk about documents which look like 2D things in people's mind, where you actually see an image of a letterlocked letter, you suddenly realize this was a 3D intricate origami bird. So it really comes to life, and it shows how these spies manipulated all these material things, such as seals and poisons and other kinds of things.
It ends with the Black Chamber. What exactly was the Black Chamber?
Well, the Black Chamber was, as Nadine's already said, the kind of professionalization of the whole business. And the first Black Chamber in the UK, certainly in England, was effectively the post office. So this was a room in which sat a bundle of operatives, usually men, who would had basically all the post coming through the room, and they would systematically open, read, translate, decode, reseal, and then send the letters on or counterfeit new versions and send them on according to necessity. So this was an active interrogation of a station for interrogating letters.
You basically have 10 men sitting around a desk. We each have their own assorted tasks. So you have linguists at hand, you have cryptanalysts at hand, you have people specialized in the folding of letters, in counterfeiting seals, a translation, quickly copying them. And it became much more efficient because time was of the essence. You don't want to alarm any kind of conspirator that you're actually reading their letters. So you don't want to detain a letter for 4 days, because then they would know that someone had possibly tampered with their information. So it has to be done really quickly and with great amount of skill.
Well, it's a brilliant new book. It's called Spycraft: Tricks and Tools of the Dangerous Trade from Elizabeth I to the Restoration. The authors Nadine Ackerman and Pete Langman, published in hardback by Yale University Press. And I'm sure you both had a huge amount of fun researching and writing it.
Oh, absolutely. We just started laughing constantly. We came across things like that people try to poison each other using toads. It is at times quite farcical.
Well, it's a brilliant new book, as I say, called Spycraft, and we'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back, we're Talking History, and to end the show tonight, we're looking at how a new book explores how European intellectual life was rebuilt after the cataclysm of the First World War. Learned communities were left in ruins by the conflict and its consequences, cultural and educational sites were destroyed, writers and artists were killed in battle, and tens of thousands of others were displaced. And against the backdrop of an unprecedented post-war humanitarian crisis which threatened millions with starvation and disease, many organisations chose to focus on assisting intellectuals and their institutions, giving them food, medicine and books in order to stabilise European democracies and build a peaceful international order. And the book is called Feeding the Mind: Humanitarianism and the Reconstruction of European Intellectual Life, 1919 to 1933. It's published in hardback by Cambridge University Press. The author is Tomás Arish. And Tomás, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Good to be back.
Can I begin with the state of play in 1919? How bad were things for European intellectual life? How much had writers and intellectuals suffered during the conflict?
Well, there's two sort of sides to this. On the one hand, by 1919, there's a major humanitarian crisis in Europe in general, which means that we have widespread starvation and famine-like conditions across lots of Central and Eastern Europe. Places like Austria and Poland are especially badly hit by that. We also have, as part of that humanitarian crisis, displacement of people. So there's a huge refugee issue at the end of the First World War. Again, this is a consequence of the fighting of the First World War itself. We can see this across sort of Central Europe, the former Habsburg Empire. A lot of displacement of people has taken place as a consequence of war. But also the Russian Civil War, which starts towards the end of the First World War, that is a consequence of displacing possibly up to 2 million people by around 1920. So this is taking place in the context of a major humanitarian crisis. And within that, then, intellectuals sort of form this group who also have suffered in different ways as a result of the war. On the one hand, we see the First World War itself, the nature of the fighting destroyed lots of institutions that were intellectual in their nature. So maybe places like universities, libraries, or buildings that were associated with sort of cultural pursuits, maybe things like cathedrals, museums, that sort of building. At the same time, intellectuals, depending how we want to define them, are also part of this wider humanitarian crisis at the end of the war. One way maybe in which intellectuals differed a bit was that a lot of the work, the kind of work they did, was premised on being international, being able to communicate across borders, being able to travel across borders, being able to collaborate with people across borders. And all of that shut down as a consequence of the First World War as well. So by 1919, we have a situation where there is a huge general humanitarian crisis in Europe. And within that, then, intellectuals have their own set of issues which have emanated from the war.
And why were intellectuals deemed worthy of protecting, given that there was this massive humanitarian crisis? Why were they identified as important, and why were the ideas that these destroyed libraries were seen, why was that seen as worth reconstructing?
Well, this is like the key question in the book, and this is something I was grappling with for sort of the 5, 6, 7 years when I was researching and writing the book. When I first began to see evidence that intellectuals were treated differently, the big question I had was why. Because in this period of this much broader humanitarian crisis, we see the emergence of big humanitarian organizations that are still with us today. Groups like Save the Children, for example, are founded in, I think, 1919, 1920. And their mission is basically to alleviate suffering where it exists. So they're not really interested in your nationality. They're not interested in things like maybe your political outlook. Save the Children is there to alleviate suffering in young people and children, because there has been widespread suffering. So it's a kind of a universal approach. But when I came across this evidence of sort of widespread aid to intellectuals, the big question I had was that, you know, this goes against the grain of a lot of what we know. It's elitist, it's selective, it treats people differently based on, you know, their education and who they were and their connections. So as I dug into it, it became apparent to me that there were a couple of reasons underpinning this. The first big one, I think, is that Europe in 1919, like you alluded to, is in, you know, it's in a state of deep flux and transitioning from the world before the First World War to the world that came after. One of the big consequences of the First World War was the collapse of these big multi-ethnic empires, which formerly were how Europe and European politics were organized. So the German Empire collapses, the Habsburg Empire, the Russian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. And it means we have a huge political vacuum in Central and Eastern Europe. New states are coming into existence. There's a lot of paramilitary violence and continued violence after the formal end of the First World War too. And a lot of this centers around your claims to becoming a state or not. There's also thrown into the mix from Russia, from the October Revolution, we have the new threat of Bolshevism. So Russia, after the fall of the Tsars, through the Russian Civil War, becomes a Bolshevik state. And this causes a huge amount of fear and a huge amount of anxiety amongst the kind of Western European statespeople and also those in the United States. So the victors of the war are worried about, on the one hand, we have this kind of political vacuum, we have the threat of Bolshevism, we have this wider humanitarian crisis I spoke about. So I think one of the reasons was that intellectuals were seen as being able to exert influence in the communities where they existed. So, for example, in places like Austria, Hungary, Poland, other Eastern European states that were coming into existence, it was felt that intellectuals might be sort of voices of stability, semi-conservative voices that would sort of bolster the liberal order and in a way, prevent the onward spread of Bolshevism. And that's something that comes out in a lot of the source material that I've looked at. People are very worried about Bolshevism and its spread, and they felt that intellectuals, I guess, were conservative traditional figures in this reading who would be able to influence their local communities or their national communities. A second part of it as well is I think that the First World War came as such a shock to Europe and to the world, as we know, for lots of different reasons. The damage done posed this question of how to rebuild in its aftermath, and especially the way that the war came to be seen as not just a military and a political phenomenon, but also something that was cultural. It was a conflict where, like I said, cultural sites had been targeted and had been severely damaged and in some cases destroyed in the course of fighting. This posed the question at the end of the war of how Europe ought to rebuild and what kind of things ought to be at the heart of reconstruction, whether it would be something new, whether it would take a different form and go in new directions, or whether it would try to shore up and reconstruct the world as it had been before 1914. I think that's also a really important part of all of this, is that it's in aiding intellectuals and intellectual institutions, it's sort of a backward-looking attempt to rebuild the world as it had been. So how do you do that? Well, you look at maybe the symbolic representations of what European life had been like before the First World War. So the emblems of high culture, university libraries that had been destroyed, for example, in Louvain in Belgium, or the cathedrals that had been damaged. You know, these symbolic representations of European culture. And allied to that then are the people who maybe inhabit these spaces, the intellectuals themselves. I think there's sort of political motivations, and then there's also maybe more intellectual or sort of cultural motivations as well.
And I think a really important part of the book is that you're not just looking at the Western Front, you're not just looking at France and Germany and Belgium, you're also looking at Austria and Russia and Serbia. And I was fascinated to read about the Bulgarian armies as they retreated. They really attempted to destroy all evidence of Serbian progress in civilization. And you talk about the cultural vandalism which occurred.
Yeah, and this is something, I guess, which we know less about in the general sense when we think of the First World War. We think of the violence on the Western Front. One of the ironies, I suppose, in what I'm looking at is that the vast bulk of the reconstruction work is taking place in Central and Eastern Europe, like you say. And while maybe the best known examples of cultural damage were ones on the Western Front, so like I mentioned, the University Library in Louvain in Belgium, and also the cathedral at Reims in northern France. This kind of behavior is actually much more widespread, I think, on the Eastern Front and in the Balkans. And certainly the example of what happened in Serbia provides good evidence of that. In fact, the first instance of cultural violence in the First World War was in Serbia. The University of Belgrade was shelled right at the beginning of the First World War, almost 110 years ago to the day, as hostilities broke out. And there was definitely a sense, I think, in the fighting, on certainly in the Balkans, that, you know, the way that the war was seen as cultural meant not only victory on the battlefield, but also the dominance and the being able to impose cultural values, cultural ideas through violence, in addition to simply just thinking of it through military terms. So that was present, like I said, on the Western Front to an extent, but I think we see much more evidence of it in the East.
And there had been, as you show, the huge destruction to churches, to museums, to libraries, to archives, that the physical reconstruction task before them was as enormous as the task of helping the individuals themselves.
Yeah, so I mean, at the level of institutions, this is very, very complex work when you think about reconstruction, because, yes, you can try and rebuild the physical institutions themselves, so the buildings, the brick and mortar. That can be challenging in the cases of maybe medieval cathedrals and churches. But then we get to the level of, let's say if we're talking about libraries or museums, the content in many cases was irreplaceable in a literal sense. If we're talking about collections that were specialist collections, maybe manuscripts of which only one example existed in the world, or artwork of different types and was the same. So this could be very, very, very complex work in order to then work out what would constitute reconstruction, whether it would be, again, a literal rebuilding of what had been there before. And in cases where, you know, like for like books, let's say we're talking about medieval manuscripts where they couldn't be sourced, what would constitute an equivalent? Likewise with things like paintings in museums, what would constitute an equivalent to in order to rebuild these institutions? In many cases, the solution to this, and this was a privilege, I guess, accorded to the victor states, they wrote into the treaties at the end of the war. So the Treaty of Versailles, for example, its reparations clauses also made provision for the return or the transfer of cultural items to France, to Belgium, in order to restock some of these institutions like libraries and museums that had been damaged or where their contents had been damaged. So the post-war settlement built that in to an extent where those kind of things weren't possible. We had very complex processes where organizations were set up in order to restock libraries, to try and find duplicates of books, to try and find things that were equivalent to maybe manuscripts that couldn't be directly replaced. And these were huge international endeavors, you know, where we might have representative committees operating in, you know, all the countries in Europe, across North America, in Japan, in different parts of the world. They were themselves going through the collections of their museums and their libraries, seeing if there were duplicates or seeing if there were maybe objects that would be appropriate, and then sending them to places like Louvain or to Belgrade or to other sites.
And I do think it's significant that you end the book in 1933, because that's a significant year in terms of, you know, the rise of Hitler and what's happening in Europe at that time. And in a way, the threats to democracy and the protection of democracy was a crucial part of their thinking as well, because they thought that helping intellectuals, helping these institutions would stabilize European democracies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the big questions I wanted to try and get my head around in researching and writing the book was, well, first of all, why intellectuals? But second, when people talked about intellectuals, what did they actually mean? You know, who were they talking about? And one of the key themes that emerges, as you rightly say, was that intellectuals were seen as having this, I guess, educational function, this function where they could inform a wider population. And that was seen as central to the promotion and the upkeep of democracy. Like I said earlier, on the one hand, it's very much an anti-Bolshevik measure. And at the same time, it's about promoting democracy and promoting democratic ideals. The end of the First World War had, with this collapse of many of the European empires, of the Central Powers, had seen then the emergence of nation states, which were, at least in the early 1920s, overwhelmingly democratic by constitution. So intellectuals had this role to play. Again, it was assumed and it was hoped in informing their wider populations and in encouraging them to be democratic. And they're sort of seen as part of, I guess, you know, encourage or sort of being part of a healthy public discourse around democracy. So by 1933, of course, the situation has changed quite a bit. Obviously, with the coming to power of the Nazis in Germany, and then in April of 1933, they pass a law which basically means that for many Jews working in the civil service and also liberal opponents of the regime, they are pushed out of their jobs. And it creates, again, a second big, essentially humanitarian crisis where we have thousands of scholars then trying to flee Germany. So the period I'm looking at after the First World War becomes very influential on how many of these organizations from 1933 organize themselves, how they work out their policy, how they go about saving many of these very famous German scholars and intellectuals who end up going to places like the UK. They go to North America, famously people like Albert Einstein and Thomas Mann and others. And there's a very strong connection between what happens after the First World War and what happens after 1933. Many of the people involved in helping these refugee scholars had been involved after the First World War, and many of the same connections were brought into play and many of the same kind of policies were enacted.
And it is interesting that you also have all of these new international organizations being created, and culture has an important role in some of those as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the key one that's set up after the First World War is the League of Nations. So the League of Nations is the forerunner or the precursor to the modern United Nations, set up again as a consequence of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. The covenant of the League of Nations, it's sort of the equivalent of the UN Charter that it operated under, that was written into all of the post-war peace treaties. So the Treaty of Versailles contains the Covenant of the League of Nations. And the League, once it was set up, it was initially seen as having a primarily diplomatic function, I think, you know, to avert future wars by encouraging countries to come together and to cooperate together. However, once it was established, I think it quickly worked out and determined that it would have to take on many additional responsibilities in order to address the many and complex reasons that can lead to the outbreak of hostilities between states, whether they were economic, humanitarian, and so on. But one of the key ones was to do with culture and intellectual life, if you like, and education. So the League set up a number of bodies that dealt with these issues, the first in 1922. And the thinking behind a lot of this was, again, that if we want to encourage a peaceful Europe and a peaceful world, we need to be able to cooperate culturally as well as politically. So that meant then thinking about things like, I guess, getting together representative figures from different countries, from Germany and France and Britain and different parts of the world to share their ideas about their respective nations. But it also went further than that. And, you know, they looked at things like, what do we do about school, the way the history is taught in different schools and what's written in school textbooks around Europe, especially between Germany and France. You know, if they're still teaching very hostile histories of the recent past, what hope have we for a peaceful future? So the League of Nations was very interested in a lot of these things. It didn't necessarily achieve a great deal of success in that line of work, I think. But what is significant about it, I think, is that a lot of the work it did in the interwar period through things like cultural cooperation then fed into the establishment of organizations like UNESCO. When the United Nations is set up during the Second World War, UNESCO sort of builds on this previous work done by the League of Nations, and it determines that, you know, things like cultural cooperation, wider cultural knowledge and cultural understanding needs to be at the heart of reconstruction and a stable world.
Okay, well, Tomás, thank you so much for joining us tonight to talk about your new book. It's called Feeding the Mind, Humanitarianism and the Reconstruction of European Intellectual Life, 1919 to 1933. It's part of the Studies in the Social and Cultural History of Modern Warfare series published by Cambridge University Press. The author, as I say, Tomás Arish. And Tomás, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Marisa Sullivan, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.